Hi, I'm Hazel Dooney. My guest today is an artist, curator, gallerist, lecturer in art history, digital art, and art and economics, and writer with a notorious column at artnet.com and a book on NFTs coming out in November. Henny Schachter, thank you so much for taking the time to join me today. And is that the correct pronunciation of your name?
My last name is, it's Schachter. Thank
Schachter.
you for having me. And I'm not a gallerist
Oh,
by
you're
any
not.
stretch of the imagination. No,
I
thank
thought
you.
that
I
you
got enough
had
on my
galleries or
plate.
dealing or.
Well, I had an exhibition space that was designed by the conceptual artist Vito Acconci. And that was the main reason I had the space just to work with him.
Oh, cool.
And I've collected loads of art throughout my career. So when all else fails, I resort to selling bits and pieces of my collection, including the last 4 years at Sotheby's in a single owner, tongue-in-cheek, kind of performative auction called The Hoarder, which is like a pejorative term for collectors. So it's more like a conceptual thing and a cash-raising event at the same time.
That's really fascinating. I like that. I like your intellect. You're really interesting. One of the things I like about your work is that you apply the creative problem solving that artists use in art to life. And not everyone does that. You would think they do, but it's actually quite rare.
Interesting. Yes, I would say, like, it was funny because I was saying to someone the other day that the art world operates in economic theory, it's called a zero-sum game, where one person or one artist advances at the expense of somebody else.
Yeah, I
And,
don't know how sustainable that is long term, but yeah, I agree. Yeah.
well, I mean, the point is, like, back to, I mean, I think that my whole life I live in terms of a zero-sum game, because the only thing that gives me satisfaction in life and joy, or what resembles joy, is my work and my art and teaching, writing, and making it. Those are the three core elements to what I do. And there's really absolutely nothing else I would r rather do instead.
I think
So
it's
if
a
I, if
need
you,
for artists. Yeah.
I mean, if you gave me like an all-expense seven-star trip on a beach somewhere, that to me would be a torture. Unless it was a great Wi-Fi and I could just sit there and work on my laptop.
Now I understand what you mean. It's the need. It's the need to make art. I'm in my studio in Sydney. It's an early morning, not quite full daylight yet, but it looks like it's going to be a beautiful day. Where are you and what's it like there?
That's a really funny question that you asked me, because it's a Sunday and it's a holiday weekend, and of course I'm home reading theses from my graduate students. I'm the advisor to three students, and I've been writing reports all weekend, even though it's a holiday called Memorial Day weekend, which kicks off the summer
That's
in
in New
America.
York, right?
Yeah, so I'm in New York City, and I kind of spaced out about our talk today because it's a holiday, and I just finished filing my second of three reports for my students. And I went for a walk in the park, and I had set my alarm to remind me of our talk. So I'm in Central Park, sitting in a patch of
Oh,
dirt
wow.
with my kid, with my kid's dog that I'm babysitting in my lap,
That's so
basically.
cool. That's
And
so
that's where
of
I
the
am.
times. Yeah.
Yes. And I just bumped into some really cool artist, Trey Abdullah, who has a show coming up in the fall, who just recognized me as this lunatic sitting in the dirt
Doing
in the Central Park.
a
But that's, you asked
podcast in
me.
Australia.
Yes, that's where I am.
You're a highly adaptable person. I like it.
Yep.
So you have an exhibition at the moment called Slow Food. At NFT Gallery, which may or may not change their name, at 88 Clinton Street, New York, until the 17th of June. I watched a Vernissage TV video of it on your website, kennyschachter.art, and I'll include a link with the podcast so people can visit online. In the
Thank
video,
you.
there are life-size sculptures of cartoon art world characters, screens of the characters standing and looking in at the gallery space. There's a dinosaur skeleton with it looks like your head on it, with and what seems to be a merch table, then pages on a wall that I think people are writing on. It feels like an integration of worlds of the physical and digital, and I'd really love to talk to you about the work in that show. I understand there are three new ongoing projects, but I'd just love to hear about it.
Thanks. Well, I've been in a little bit of a ongoing conversation, let's say, with the owners of the gallery, three young Europeans, two from Switzerland and one from Germany, about the nomenclature, the name they use for the gallery, because I've been making art for between 30 and 35 years. And
yeah, you were very early with the digital. Yeah.
Right. Because for me, I'm not interested. Like, I can't paint. I can't draw a stick figure. But I mean, I'm interested in conceptual art and like giving form to ideas.
Yeah.
And for me, like, contemporary art is meant to be, whether no matter what you're doing, painting, sculpture, any art form, it's meant to be in some form or another a reflection of the times we live in, social, political, economic, and technological.
Sure.
So artists are very opportunistic and grab whatever is at hand. I mean, I taught a studio practice class at School of Visual Arts, and it was really challenging. I had to give like a 7-hour lecture, which was meant to be a mixture of studio critiques, but I thought it was really, I mean, in a way, it was really inspirational and stirring to try to get the artists to make stuff with whatever they can extend their hands to in their apartments.
Yeah.
So in a way, like, I've always employed technology, not as someone who was like a hobby coder or a programmer or anything of the sort. Rather, I've always appreciated just what's around me and been aware and really been like, got my hands on a computer in the 80s when there wasn't even a laptop. It was a desktop with a floppy disk. And then just tried to interface with the computer as much as I possibly could to have that experience and to be able to utilize it in the way that I think and the way that I act in the art world. So I made my first digital animation in 1993. And shortly after that, I was exhibiting overscale digital prints on vinyl that had elements extrapolated, like pulled out by painting them in. And so it's really, I mean, so a gallery today, like, I have a problem with a gallery called the NFT gallery.
It's a bit restrictive already, in terms.
Yeah,
it restricts, I mean, it to one medium.
Yeah. I mean, if people were more open-minded in the world, it wouldn't make a rat's ass of a difference. But because there's a lot of prejudice in terms of, like, the art world is archly conservative and people are very dismissive
it's
of
funny,
something.
It's funny, isn't it?
Yeah,
it's funny.
I don't find it so funny. I find
it's not
frustrating.
Funny as in peculiar. Yeah.
Yes. I mean, because I studied philosophy. I never knew about the art world until I was much older in my 20s. And I call myself idiot savant, thought that art went from an artist to a museum. And I wasn't even cognizant of the art world until later in life, like I said.
Well, it's a highly opaque world. So, I mean, it's really hard for anyone to be cognizant of it until one has experienced it.
Right. So before I experienced it and I first like started to learn a little bit about it, I had this romantic notion of the art world to be like this arena of pure freedom of like it.
Oh, no. I had the same
where people
fantasy.
I envisioned like people drinking absinthe and swinging from a chandelier and getting up to all sorts of untoward things, but it was the exact opposite. So at that stage, after studying philosophy and political science, I went to law school because I was just biding my time because I didn't know what I wanted to do. And we spend 80% of our entire lives in the workplace. And I was damn sure that I wasn't going to do what I didn't want to do, but I wasn't certain what it was that I did want to do because I wasn't aware that art could be a vocation, a way of life. And I went to law school, though I never went to class, and I took a series of full-time jobs and just took the exams. And I was in everything from floor of the stock exchange, fashion business, and as a freelance writer for law firms. And that's where I learned to hone my writing skills.
Oh,
and so in a way, I guess that really colored the way my entire approach to art is sort of, even though I'm firmly entrenched in the art world, it would be crazy for me not to be after all these decades, but I will always feel like there's a big X on my head as an outsider. And like NFTs immediately alienate 3/4 of the art world, if not more, because people have already written it off as like a fad and a passing phenomenon that isn't going to last, which is completely a misconception. Because again, like, I like art. That's what I'm crazy in love with and passionate about. And you can call it whatever you want, but that's insignificant. The point is, I love art, and my art comes in all different forms. I have a tapestry in my show, videos, sculpture, a painting, so, and an installation. So really, you know, the names and the categorizations and the pigeonholing are really something that comes after the fact. And the thing that I'm purely interested in is art, everything about art, the art world, the art market, artists, the relationships, the interrelationships, the dynamics, and all of that. And that's really the fodder for a large part of what I do, but not all of it.
Yeah, I agree that I hope they do change their name, but it's really fascinating to hear about just the interconnectedness of your interests. And you seem to be really interested in, you're obviously a very skilled communicator, and you seem to be genuinely interested in communicating and connecting.
Well, that's a great point, because like, I'm trying to really turn more of that aspect of what I do. I kind of hate the word practice. It's so pretentious, but I'm trying to incorporate this performative aspect to my life into the actual art manifestation. So art is really a means of self-expression, but also just as crucially, communication. So
yeah, because if it's
really
expression
that
encapsulates
what I'm doing.
Yeah. Because if it's expression without the communication, it just kind of hits a wall. But when you can press some buttons in someone else's mind, in the mind of someone who's looking at it, that's when it gets really exciting, I think.
Yeah, and I think it's about engaging communities, having conversations.
Just going back to the NFT thing, I think digital, regardless of whether or not they're called NFTs in the future, I think that digital assets are definitely here to stay and of the future. For me, when I think about the gallery name, it's kind of as similar to if someone said it's the gallery for charcoal drawings on paper. It's just it becomes about the medium, whereas art is really about the ideas. So regardless, fantastic that they've opened a gallery, and the address is 88 Clinton Street, New York. So, you know, people can find it if they did change their name. So in your show, I read that you're presenting three new ongoing projects: Open Book, Artillery, and Jabberwock. Could we talk about one of those? Or all of them?
Yeah, I mean, because I'm always changing and always contradicting myself, I've since changed the name of two of them.
Oh, what are they?
Well, the first, instead of Artillery, which was going to be a video game, because there's basically this gulf that separates the traditional art world and the digital art world. So
yeah,
I don't like to
I
call,
agree.
I mean, I don't care about the word NFT, or I don't like to call them assets. That's because artists have used computers since the 50s. I mean, I have photographs from the 50s from Herbert Franke and Gottfried Jaeger. I just got some photographs from the 60s that employ computer technology. So in any event, I was initially going to do this video game because there's been a bit of a battle, really, that I've experienced as someone who just early cottoned on to the blockchain in relationship to creating digital certificates of authenticity that could be bought and sold with certainty.
Yeah, and your crypto
online
series has been huge. Yeah.
So really that to me is, I've been making digital art. And if you look at the recent history of some of the greatest practitioners of digital art and video art, like Steve McQueen, the British artist who made the film 12 Years a Slave. Right. So his auction record is $30,000. That's disgraceful. It should be millions and millions of dollars for his work. Or Isaac Julian, who makes film, and Bruce Nauman and his videos, or Bill Viola, the world's most illustrious and famous video artists, have never sold a video. The only video that's ever really sold for over $1 million is like Nam June Paik. And that was because it was part and parcel of a sculpture. So I just think that, you know, why should other forms of art, like, we live in a digital age. I'm sitting here on my telephone in the dirt in Central Park. You're in Australia. We're using a software app to communicate with each other. Everyone is on the phone. Everyone is using technology and using apps.
It's a necessity now.
Yes. And like, I just read the thesis paper I read today, used AI translation, super sophisticated AI translation application to render this paper from French to English in a really, you know, in a way that's highly accurate.
That's actually quite complex to do. I'm studying French and I understand that that's actually quite a sophisticated thing to do because of the gender in the languages.
Right. So like already people are up and all, I mean, I'm going to be all over the place because that's the way my brain is, like an atom smasher.
That's but cool. Like, it's interesting.
People are moaning and groaning about AI and ChatGPT, but like, you know, so what? Of course, everyone's worried that like these tools will be used for nefarious, you know, bad acting purposes. But the point is, I've never met a dishonest computer in my life. It's the people that employ them to dishonest means where the problem lies. Yeah. So in any event, like, what's around me. Yeah, yep. So the video, thanks. Thank you for directing me back on the road. I'll rely on you from now on
We finish. I'm happy to do that. Happy to play that role, yeah.
So I made a conceptual video about over a year ago that I released on Nifty Gateway, and it was a video game with like pitting traditional artists in battle, in a Mortal Kombat with crypto artists. And like David Hockney, who's one of the true brilliant artists
I'm a huge fan as a painter.
Yeah, me too.
Myself, yeah.
Right. So, he used to be like, I mean, he was really an early adapter of technology.
Yeah, he had all of those beautiful iPad drawings.
Exactly. So meanwhile, even like if someone comes up to me and says, "Can you explain what an NFT is?" Which is probably most people, but I use David Hockney because, would you rather own a photograph outputted by Pace Gallery for $50,000 for a big edition that's a certain size? Or would you rather own a high resolution file and do with it what you want? You could output it as a light box, a painting, a photograph, or a projection on the front of your house if that was your interest. But meanwhile, David Hockney has said
that NFTs, I love it in the medium it's created. Yeah. David Hockney,
he's called NFTs like for petty criminals. So
well,
so
people
video
are still
game,
getting
like,
their head around digital assets. It's like,
yeah,
the world has
but like,
changed, but people are still catching up to that reality.
So in the first version of the video game, you had like David Hockney shooting people between the eyes. And then when I thought of fleshing out the game into an actual game, I was gonna call it Artillery with ART capitalized, and the game was gonna be a nonviolent sort of encounter with paintball guns and the, you know, non-lethal combat. But then I just thought, you know, we live in a day and age with so much violence, and especially where I'm sitting in America, where there every single day, including today, there was yet another mass shooting.
Yeah, that is the
literally.
Heavy. I laughed about that. I laughed because I was thinking of it with paintballs and stuff like that. And then I kind of started to think about actual violence
feel
a bit heavier.
I don't want to add to that equation. There's too much as it is. So then I just thought I actually used ChatGPT to help me facilitate coming up with a name that would incorporate something nonviolent. And I figured, like, aside from there being two camps in the art world, the digital camp, the crypto artists, and the traditional art world, art is also, so much of life is a popularity contest, in a sense, where, you know, everything is measured by likes and followers in this, you know, social media day and age. And also, like in the art world, what your prices are at galleries or at auction. And these are very reductive, horrible ways of...
Well, sometimes they're artificially constructed too.
Yes, there's a lot of manipulation that happens in the auction world in particular. But some of my favorite artists, including Paul Tech, an American artist who died of AIDS in 1988, literally working in a supermarket after being in major global international exhibitions during the course of his career. And then Vito Acconci, a very famous conceptual artist who died, I think, in 2016, who died destitute. Some of, you know, I'm really interested in looking at the misconceptions. The art world has its own brand of hypocrisy, which is pretty awful. So, So this game, in the end, I call it Pop Principle. The principle being like all of these variables that impact upon creative lives and what artists are deemed successful in the world and what's the criteria for judging them as such. So
the game is called Top Principle. I like that added depth. Yeah.
And then there's open editions of a group of crypto artists, a group of traditional artists, and a few critics and curators. And then it's like who sells the most within a 30-day open edition period will determine who's the most, who's. So it's really, you know, it's meant to be satirical. Like humor is one of the most consistent and considerable attitudes in my art, because when you're highly critical, as I am in my writing especially, having a dollop of humor helps people digest a little more easily the harshness of your criticality.
For sure. And I really appreciate that in your work. I enjoyed on your site, you've got a section where you have some of your videos, which I really enjoyed.
Thank you.
There's one of a couple of Damien Hirst and some other people where it's kind of critique. And then you've got one on NFTs. And it's interesting that there are some serious ideas in there, but you're presenting it in a way that's fun. And it's kind of poking fun at, and you're not taking yourself too seriously at the same time. So it's really enjoyable to watch. And sometimes things can in art can get a little bit over serious. Like I really enjoy the fun aspect of it. And it was interesting.
Well, in a way, like you said, that's a really great point. Well, you're right. Like I don't take myself seriously, but at the same time,
I'm deadly serious. It is serious, but
I'm deadly serious about what I do. But again, like humor is a great disarming mechanism. And like when I'm lecturing, for instance, and I can't even tell you the countless amount of hours it takes to prepare for one, you know, hour long lecture. But if you're not, there's some degree of entertainment. It's an attention economy back.
Well, you
to
want
the
to engage.
Game.
Yeah. Didactic is really, it's like being scolded. It's far more.
Exactly.
Far better.
So I have I'll have 150 images in my presentation that are rammed with information, but if I can convey it in a way that somehow is not lighthearted, but again, like is funny and in some basic sense, like, you know, it's part stand up and part like university lecture from the 50s or something. I just try to make it somewhat, you know, to stop people from dropping into deep REM sleep, like probably a few people are today listening to this after we're done. And this is posted with me rambling on. And
No. The feedback I've had is that people like it. People like listening to it. People like listening to people just have a long conversation and usually do other things at the same time. So I've suggested to people that I shorten it or edit it, and everyone said no. So please don't feel that way. Turns
Let
out
it
people
roll.
Like
Let
it.
Me
yeah.
hang myself on my own petard.
People just like it. It's more human.
Yeah. Good. Well, the other project that I'm working on is called Open Book. And I was commissioned to co-author a book on NFTs about a year ago by a scholar from Cambridge. And I was meant to recount the 3 years that I've been involved in NFTs. And in doing so, I found it really difficult. And I'm a journalist, a kind of investigative journalism about the art world at the same time of my teaching and my art making. But I found
great
it
articles,
really,
by the way, great articles. Yeah.
Oh, thank you so much. I just have one that came out last week. And I take less money to ensure that my work is in front of the paywall so everyone can access it, because that's very important to me.
Much appreciated. And I'm sure that a lot of young artists appreciate that too. Yeah.
Yes. So anyway, like the idea of writing a book proved to be very formidable for me, because I'm always in the moment or looking what's next. I really don't like to live retrospectively and dwell in things that have happened already. Life is so short. I want to fulfill my life in the most fruitful way that I can without reiterating things. So I found it really difficult. And as I was writing my portion of the book, it occurred to me that technology travels with a great rapidity and velocity, to the extent that 1 year in technology is like dog years. Like, you know,
yeah, definitely.
Where one dog year is 15 years in real life. And I felt with technology, 1 year is 15 years in real life as well. Mm. So in any event, I decided, like, why? How could you have a technology book? A book has a beginning, a middle, and an end. And this is a subject that transforms at beyond the speed of, like, of light, the speed of sound, even quicker. So I had the idea of working with this platform called Async, which is a pioneer in developing dynamic NFTs that transform over time. So when people say NFTs are really a certificate of authenticity, or, I mean, people say that an NFT is a marketplace to trade digital assets. But if you use the smart contract as the underlying content, then the NFT becomes a new art form. And the idea of a non-fixed artwork that changes over time is... There's the dog. Excuse me.
That's right.
I like that. A little protest from the peanut gallery. I like when you think, I mean, Marcel Duchamp said art should have a shelf life in a museum, that it should only, you know, have a 50-year period of being on exhibition or being in a collection. And I love the idea of, like, I'm writing this digital book with 20 extraordinary co-contributors in my open book project with Async. And then people from outside the project could make contributions. So the idea is that the book is forever evolving and changing. So you can have an NFT that will look different 1 month to the next month when subsequent contributions are airdropped into the wallet. So that to me is really exciting because, again, like, you know, I'm not interested in the novelty of an NFT just for the sake of a new way to sell art. That is the least interesting aspect to me, but I'm interested in new ways of thinking and new forms of the art itself. And that is what I feel.
That's what I find interesting about your
work.
NFTs have
the potential to be.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank that's you. Really fascinating. And I look forward to seeing how that evolves. Yeah. That is, just kind of getting my head around what you described, which is really cool. And it,
thank you.
I also had those thoughts. I love books. I'm a big reader, but they are static. And, you know, and it, you made that point about NFTs and technology. It's just constantly changing. And yeah, that fits. That idea fits.
So that'll come. I'm giving a keynote lecture in this NFT Art Day in Zurich on the 11th of June, which will be recorded. And that really, for me, is...
Will people be able to watch that on your site?
Yes, it'll be on my site, and it's on NFT Art Day. I guess they have a YouTube channel.
Yeah.
But for me, that's like the biggest convergence I've seen to date of the coinciding of, I hate the word, like, I mean, it's the word traditional art world is so kind of antiquated, but in effect, it really is true. I mean, if you look at, like, if you go to an art auction, like just what transpired last week in New York, and you look at, like, what's garnering the most attention and money is mainly painting, and paintings that are painted today that very well could have been painted 30 or 40 or 50 years ago. So yeah, so that will, the NFT series open book, I'm not shilling myself, but that comes out on the 13th of October.
Well, I've invited you here to talk about your work, so please do.
of June, I'm like, I'm in another planet right now. In the shade of the trees in Central Park. But anyway, so, but in the end, another thing of what I love about NFTs is that, like I said, I mentioned before, conversations and community, but it's also collaboration. And all of these things grew to be missing in the art world, which is really just like this kind of cottage industry, entrepreneurial business. The contemporary art world, I say that I went into art to get away from big business, and then the art world turned into a bigger business than the businesses I was running away from. And although the NFT world became largely dominated by speculation in a very,
it did have a wave of being the worst.
In 2 years, it aped the worst attributes of the fine art market, and it was depressing. However,
but then it seems like it's moved beyond that.
Well, the markets collapsed. It didn't constrict. Since last June, it evaporated, although it's showing signs of life. And as far as I'm concerned, that's the best damn thing that could have ever happened, because
I agree,
it washed
actually.
out all the you know, cash grabbers and scammers and bots and stuff. So anyway, that will come out, and that's exciting. And the artists that have contributed, people like Krista Kim and Sarah Mayohas and Claudia Hart and Operator, which is a collaborative group with two artists, and Kevin Abash, a whole host, including Jerry Saltz and Hans Ulrich Obrist. There's 20 initial core collaborators, and you could like cherry pick your own chapters to make your own book. And now at my exhibition, there's an installation I set up where people can write down their own thoughts on the subject, and that too will become part of the book.
Those are the pages that I saw that people are
yes,
writing.
Yes, and the thing is that all of the artists that contributed, they receive like 90% of the proceeds from any of the sales of their NFTs. So this collaborative aspect and these conversations that are being created, that really reminds me of what the art world was like in the early 90s when I got involved, when there was a deep recession in America and people were coming out of the woodwork to do projects for all the right reasons because of their love and passion for art. And that's really today, nothing's changed in what I do, how I do it, or how I think about it. The tools are changed, but the mentality and the mindset has not even budged one iota.
Yeah, I see that very strongly looking at an overview of your work. So you also have you also do sculpture and video with the
yes, like again,
work,
like yeah. So that I changed the name of that to Velociraptor, which is the name of a dinosaur, a small dinosaur, 75 million years old. Which
it
was
sounds
called
very contemporary,
thief.
Though.
Yes, it was called the Swift Thief. That's the Latin term, Velociraptor, and it had to do, the impetus for that piece was something I found really disheartening, was seeing auction houses begin to drop dinosaur skeletons into contemporary art evening sales, selling for tens of millions of dollars to contemporary art collectors like baubles in a jewelry store. I just found it really kind of disgusting, because these are things, if anything belongs in the public domain besides like artistic masterpieces and like all of the plundering from colonialism, all of these, like, you know, the Elgin marbles in the British Museum, it's a disgrace that, you know, the remnants of this era of subjugation are still borne out in museums and by governments, and ripping up dinosaur bones and then selling them it's outrageous. And these things belong either in academic institutions or in natural history museums. So I had the idea of like thinking of life and death, and art is always used as, you know, content, this notion of death and the fine line, the fragility of life and the frailty. So
yes. Yeah.
I recreated one of these ancient dinosaur skeletons minus the head. And the head was a kind of zombified 3D version of my own head, which is not readily identifiable as my own head.
Yeah, I wasn't quite sure. I thought maybe yes. Not. And then does it have a mohawk bone?
Sorry? Does it have
a mohawk that's a kind of bone on top?
No, yeah, well, it has a bit of hair because my skull is shaped like on an angle and I have a built-in mohawk. I have to literally like cut my hair every day or I have a mohawk by default.
And
my
punk,
kid, one of my kids critiques me saying that I depict myself too often in my own art, and he finds it a bit narcissistic. Although the other one called me a narcissist with low self-esteem. But
ooh, brutal.
So my family is like a roving art university where we're constantly supporting each other but critiquing each other, which is really an amazing
dynamic.
It's
actually important to have critiquing, I think.
Of course, as long as it comes from a good place, as long as it comes from a constructive, there's nothing worse than like gratuitous criticism. And that's also part of the history of my dinosaur sculpture, because not till I had success selling my NFTs did I get representation by various galleries in my life. And one of my galleries
That's an interesting
were,
contradiction, yeah.
Well, no, a success, a firm success in the art world. So
okay, I get it. Yeah,
and that's
I just think it's
artists...
funny because you're saying that, you know, people rejected NFTs so heavily, but then you had success in something that happened to be NFTs, and then that was accepted. So it was the success.
Well, one gallery asked me to curate an NFT show because some other people in the art world said they would never be able to understand it. So they asked me if I would advise them, and I told them I would curate the show. The show went really well, and they ended up representing every artist in the show, and including me. But then when I mentioned this skeleton piece to the gallery, one of the gallerists said, "This is bad, bad art." And I found that to be so, it was hurtful, to be honest. I mean, it hurt my
feelings. Well,
I
wouldn't say that saying something is bad art. I don't think that's a useful critique. Like, it's no, not, you it, can't really have a conversation not. About that. I think that's more of a, it's a kind of gatekeeper statement. That doesn't, it can't really go anywhere. And exactly. Art is subjective. So I'm not sure that, you know, people change their mind about art. It changes.
Yeah, including me.
I'm not sure that good or bad really.
I changed my mind during the duration of this conversation. I always change my mind. And some of the art that I hated the most, or even like I disliked CryptoPunks when I first saw them. And then I grew to appreciate the paradigm shifting nature of this project as a kind of digital collectible, which was a new category of thing in and of itself. And I grew, and that... I dislike things. And I also, I mean, I don't mean to contradict you, but I don't believe art is, I think personal taste and aesthetic is subjective, but I don't think good art, or I don't think art is subjective. I think good art has an inherent quality to it. I think that our collective consciousness changes and shifts over time. So things get reassessed over the course of history. But if something's good, it was good when no one liked it, as well as being good when people finally come around.
I agree with you. I think good art is good art, but people may or may not like it, especially the first time they see it, because sometimes when people see something new, it just, they don't have what you described before, which is they don't have someone else affirming it beforehand. So we all have to make up our mind, and people have some uncertainty, even if it is good.
And I always say that the only thing worse than being behind the time is to be too far ahead of the time, exactly what you said, when there's no consensus. And when some, like, basically I'm not the evangelist for NFTs. I don't care. I really don't give a fuck, to tell you the truth. But I just think in a technological age where people use computers to make stuff, then NFTs are nothing short of a revolution, in which it's a mechanism to trade these things and to be able to have assurances or you know, to declare that something is what it purports to be, authentic or inauthentic, and to be able to reliably, with certainty, trade it amongst people.
I think these things will increase.
It's easy to do that with the painting, but not with the video, you know?
Yeah.
Anyway, and that's really all I care about. So I'm only interested in, you know, again, like, different systems that can have practical applications in my creative life and the life of my students and my peers. But I tell you that there's so much resentment and animosity when you're at the forefront of something that people are not terribly comfortable with.
Yeah, I understand that. I started using the internet to connect directly with the audience for my work in 2004. And then by 2006, it had gained some traction, and it was reported on the front page of the business section of one of the national newspapers, or one of the state newspapers.
Amazing.
But the pushback that I received was just wild. Like, people were, I was really excited about it, and I thought, oh, we're going to have some great conversations, and this is a new thing, and, you know, things will change. But the pushback was just enormous. So I think that kind of human nature recoils
from the unfamiliar. People, you know. But anyway, it makes me think of this interview I saw with David Bowie in the 90s. He said that the internet, exactly what you were saying, in the way you use the internet to communicate directly with your audience, David Bowie said, like, using the internet and the web was a way for artists to conflate, to get rid of the gap between the artist and the audience, to do away with the separation. And the separation comes from galleries, record companies, all of these corporate interests. And now, you know, and that was a brilliant observation about, you know, especially people use this term Web3, but connecting your crypto wallet or your wallet to websites and obviating the need to deal with these third parties is a tremendous leap. And the next phase where we're due for a radical departure is in relationship to social media, because right now, Instagram is so fundamentally flawed between that censorship.
You were just
between the Yeah, I got really badly censored and received hundreds of hate mails from posting a painting by a 74-year-old Swiss painter of all things. Which I didn't even like.
I like that painting. I mean, it's horrible, but I thought it was important. It was truthful.
Well, Miriam Khan is a 74-year-old painter who's been making art for 50 years. She made a painting about rape and subjugation in the war in Ukraine. And there was,
it's important to be honest about these things.
Yeah. And she depicted an explicit sexual act, and the painting was defaced and vandalized in the Palais de Tokyo. And then the French legislature adjudicated on it and decided and judged the painting should remain where it was and where it was intended to be seen by the public. No one forces someone to go to a museum and see something.
Well,
I don't force anyone.
To
go to my Instagram account, but I mean, I honestly was hoping that I would get censored by Instagram before they actually ultimately did. It took 3 or 4 days. And during that time, I received death threats, hate mail, and lost 400 followers. And, you know, I don't think that Mark Zuckerberg is in any position to be this oracle of what's right and what's wrong in the morality police in the world today. If anything, that company should be split up by Monday, and it has a monopoly on various platforms of communication that's wildly disproportionate to most governments in power. And the same with Twitter and
Amazon.
We've
seen the influence
of social
media. Yeah.
Yeah, all of these companies they're all so centralized by these omnipotent powers.
Yeah, it's definitely become problematic. Folks.
It's very problematic. So I'm hoping that in the not so distant future, blockchain will be deployed to incorporate social media where we will be alone responsible for our own platforms individually. And that's the beauty of you know, crypto is, I mean, right now it's more decentralization in name only, but the more that these things are accessible, the interfaces have to be made easier to use. And once these things are opened up and made more democratic and non-hierarchical, we'll have a better world to live in with less hate.
I think that will be, I'm excited for those changes. Recently, I've started using Substack. And although that's a centralized platform, it's not as controlled. It's not as controlling.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's got a lot of really good tools. You can, well, this podcast will be hosted there. So it's got audio, video.
Oh, great.
And people can connect with each other. Do you remember in the early days of the net, or early-ish, or in the 90s, when people had websites and people often had a page of links to other artists and other people they were interested in? And so sometimes people these days talk about social media as a necessity, but no, it's just, you know, we can find other ways to connect with each other and to refer to each other.
Yes, I think, I mean, aside from AI and all of that business, I think a big departure in the way social media is organized and conducted right now is on the near horizon. I hope so anyway.
Yeah, I do too. I have something I was curious about. You said that you're not formally educated and that you're self-taught. And I was wondering how come you didn't, because I am too, actually. So I was wondering how come you didn't, because you've obviously studied in other areas.
Well, the fact was, I mean, I studied philosophy and political science undergraduate. There was no proper job to get with an undergraduate philosophy degree. So being more pragmatic, I thought I would take a simultaneous PhD in philosophy and legal degree that would give me more opportunity in the job market. And then once I undertook the legal studies, it was way too overwhelming. And I decided to take a different track, which was to quit school, not tell anybody, tell my employers I was in night school, and then just take the exams and field a different series of jobs that would help. Help me determine largely. I used it to, in the negative sense of trying to figure out what I didn't want to do, which was necessary before I was able to even determine what it is I did want to do.
Yeah, it can be a really useful tool.
Yeah. So after that, sitting here on my ass in Central Park, and I could teach anyone about post-war art in a period of months. But when I determined to get involved more heavily in crypto art, I spent 2 years. I quit writing for ArtNet, except for a dozen features on NFTs. I quit doing what gave me the most notoriety and audience. And I decided to submerge myself to learn about the building blocks of the history of digital art and crypto.
So which you did is something that by by yourself? You just studied?
I reached out to a couple of mentors online.
Yeah.
One was an executive. One was a Singaporean executive at Google who, out of the sheer generosity of spirit that I found existed in the early days of crypto.
Yeah.
Another one was a historian of generative art.
Did you know these people previously?
Nope.
Okay.
Nope. And like literally,
this
reminds me of a very crucial fact that I would like to say to you before everyone falls asleep. I return every DM, every email, every inquiry to me, no matter how delivered, if even with a pigeon with a note on its leg, I will answer every single query to me within 24 hours usually. And if I can help, I help. So in the same way,
I really appreciated that in your response to me. Yeah.
Yeah. So the generosity of spirit, I feel compelled that it's part of the obligation of what I do. It's just as easy to say yes as it is to say no. And I find that the word the art world knows more than any other word is the word N-O. You can't do this, say that, behave like this, etc. And I love to inspire people and to help people have some of the same positive experiences in my career as I've had. And back to your question, I realized at the time that I had to learn, if I wanted to devote my life to art, knowing everything about art post, 40s wasn't going to do the trick. I had to know what happened when the art came off the wall of the cave. And to do so, I couldn't bear the thought of going back to organized classroom study. So I conned my way into a teaching job at the New School based on the fact that I had curated 6 shows and was hired for 6 lectures. And I bought Janssen's Book of Art History and then would read 3 chapters, drink a big beer to get my gumption up and then teach it. And then the dean that hired me left the school and I was on the books as an adjunct professor. And that was in 1992. And I have not stopped lecturing since then. I always joke that it's the only way I get people to listen to me is to have a captive audience. But I teach to learn and to share and to help people. And that, I have a class from the Art Institute of Chicago next Friday. I'm literally teaching every week, basically, at disparate universities all over, besides having teaching positions intermittently at School of Visual Arts and NYU. And I've been a professor at the University of Zurich for almost 15 years now.
I really appreciate the openness in the way that you talk. It is really generous. And the kind of honesty, almost to a fault, which I really like.
It doesn't alleviate the economic pressure that I have, because all of the things that I hold most dearest to my heart and my creative aspects of my life, I don't get remunerated for. The writing, I take a reduced salary, so it's free. Teaching is intermittent and obviously not well paid enough. And the rest is selling my art. I had a good run with NFTs for about a year, and then that came to a grinding halt. And that's it. And then it's just selling incrementally bits of my collection. So
I think that might be just, for many people, the nature of art. I was talking with an artist friend the other day and saying that kind of, it's like the uncertainty that comes with what we all do.
Yeah.
That's certain, like quite a nerve-wracking part of it. Yeah, but
certain
we're
uncertainty.
All, yeah,
but I love it. I mean, I would so never compromise. Anyway. I would never compromise what I do. I'd rather make less money, doing what I love the way I love to do it without capitulation or compromise. And if someone tells me, like this gallery did, that my art was bad, I'd rather just find another context for it and never change the course of what I do or how I do it, because I would rather resort to other means to resolve my economic needs, which I do buy.
I think it's a better long-term strategy. I actually read something that one of your comments when someone asked you about corruption in artists, and you said something along the lines of when ambition outstrips talent, which I think is a short-term strategy. But I think that just staying true to what one does, we never really know how things will turn out.
Yeah. For some artists, that mentality pays out in the long term by endlessly repeating themselves and doing things. I mean, but that's like Damien Hirst. Damien Hirst
was a brilliant
artist.
They call that a pot boiler here. It's like they say it's what keeps the pot boiling so you can eat. They call it a pot boiler to constantly repeat the work.
Sure. Yeah, but like Damien Hirst is a trillionaire and he made some profound, amazing works. Uh-oh, there's a squirrel dangerously approaching my dog.
I'll let you get going shortly.
That's New York City, where even the squirrels are aggressive and challenging my poor dog sitting here looking dumbfounded. Go away. Like Damien Hirst made brilliant earth-shifting pieces in the 90s.
His early work. I love A Thousand Years, where he had the flies.
Yes.
That were, you know, it was all about
in the vitrine
and death
with the cow head.
It
was a life cycle. But brilliant. In the end,
now
he just does everything he does is just for more glitz and glam. And I mean, there has to be a time where enough is enough, you know? And I think that he sacrificed anything resembling good art at the expense of just making more money for the sake of making more money and the grass is always greenerism. He's a brilliant conceptual sculptor, but somehow he feels insecure that he can't paint. So he continues to make paintings and makes this exhibitionist show.
I'm not a fan of his paintings, but I do like his conceptual art, early conceptual art.
Let's change the subject. I don't want to waste any more.
Bruce Sterling, the author, said that people get famous for the things that they, or their work, the work that they don't really want to do is the work that they're recognized for. But I am aware that you're in Central Park with squirrels and dogs, and I really appreciate that you have taken the time to talk.
There's one more last thing I would just like to mention, because through all this, I mean, really the ingredients of where I am sitting right now, other than the park, is that through sheer, like this is just like when I teach students, it's through sheer perseverance and tenacity that I'm able to have the opportunities I have today. Sometimes I get criticized as being like this powerful art world figure, which is laughable, considering I clawed my way to wherever it is I am, and that's nowhere too great, actually. But it was really just through the doggedness of never quitting and never taking no for an answer, and being self-taught and never, you know, backing down from following my dreams and my interests. And now I have my first major museum exhibition in Linz in Austria, September 5th. And there's one piece that I'm really excited about before I let you go back to your day, which is just starting as mine comes to an end. I'm trying to tie together a lot of these interests, like the teaching that we spoke about, which I just absolutely love to do and consider it part of my art practice. And I've designed like a seating element, and I'm going to create like an installation / sculptural classroom and turn my lecturing into an art sculptural performance / installation. And that's something I've never done before, a kind of live performance that will have relics as a sculptural installation, which I will exhibit in Austria. And that's something that I've always wanted to do for years and never quite gotten around to doing it. So the lectern will be a sculpture, as will like the 30 stools, seating elements. And there's also one of the world's biggest digital art conferences called Ars Electronica that is simultaneous with my exhibition. So I'll be able to incorporate this all into the mix and make this kind of art soup. And it's back to where we started this conversation of art life. And I really don't differentiate between anything I do that in life that isn't part of my the thing I love the most.
I love art. That integration. I love that the word authenticity is thrown around loosely, but I feel it feels authentic, and I really like that. There's it's kind of like a seamless transition. It doesn't seem like there's, you know, a separate life to art in what you're doing, which I really like. And I really appreciate you making the point of the importance of just continuing and perseverance and resilience. I think it's probably not mentioned enough that's extraordinarily important.
Yeah, that's enough to make the life you want to lead creatively by never giving up and never taking no for an answer and just
taking the hits and rolling with it. And as you said, if someone doesn't like it, just find another space. Yeah, just
exactly.
You know, take another action.
Because if you listen to other people, you'll do nothing. It's been incredibly peaceful talking to you in this. It's very serene and uncharacteristic for being smack in the middle of outdoors New York City for this plain air podcast conversation. But
it's
thank
so
you
wonderful.
So very much.
It's
thank
so
you
wonderful
for really
to be able to connect.
Taking the time to listen to me.
I've really enjoyed it.
I'm very appreciative.
Yeah, thank you so much. And I really look forward to just, you know, reading your writing and watching what you do and seeing where it all goes.
Thank you very much. Me and the dog are grateful. Okay.
Have a wonderful day.
Okay, you too. Bye.
Bye.